Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 463rd episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and an adjunct professor at the University of Alberta, and I'm also the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada.
Now, I'm going to say one word. I don't know if you've heard about it. COVID.
It's a shocker. It's the first. What?
Yeah. What? What does that even stand for? Anyway. So we thought today what we would do is go over. There's been a lot of really, I think, encouraging. I'm not going to give the. I don't want to give
exciting. Exciting. There's an excitement about this potential for us to see a relief from this ongoing, dare I say, nightmare COVID.
Yeah, no kidding. But there's been, as most of you guys know, there's been at least some news releases of information about two specific vaccines. And I thought what would be useful is to go over what we know so far about them. And then, Mike, you and I were going to sort of have a discussion about the nuances around industry, how medications are approved, just some general ways to think about, you know, what are we going to do when and or if this vaccine comes out?
Yeah. I think we need to start with the super duper clarification that what we're going to review today are basically just press releases. There are still no formal publications of the two vaccines that have got the most attention.
Yeah.
There are publications of vaccines as far as antibody production and things like that, and some of them even not in non-humans, but this is actual data on people. The problem is they're just press releases.
Yeah, and I think, you know, in the world that we live in right now, I think it's actually quite reasonable to have this stuff come out in news releases, in my opinion. I think, you know, given the I think your word was nightmare of the situation. Yeah. I think it's okay to do that. And we just have the caveat that these are news or press releases. And not actual publications. But you know as well as I do, actual publications don't necessarily mean that the data is perfect.
No, well then, yeah, we can talk about that. And we have talked about that.
Yeah, we don't.
And I think the term nightmare, certainly it is a nightmare for some people and for some of us sometimes.
Sure. Yeah.
But then other times there are also a few beneficial things about it. Like our carbon footprint has gone down and stuff. Oh, but I think overall this is...
Yeah.
been a real challenge for many of us.
So there's been three reports, but the two similar reports from two different companies. So just to put this into context, these are studies that have been going on since I think just about the end of July. So we're at around 3 to 4 months, and so there's no doubt that ramping up trials of 30,000 to 40,000 people in a very short period of time is very, very impressive. This is not easy stuff to do. My hat is off to all of the people who are involved in doing this. So we now have the latest report from the Pfizer vaccine, and then we have the Moderna vaccine. And both of the information that we're talking about really has come out in the last 3 or 4 days with regards to this. So obviously, the way that you study to see if a vaccine works is you randomize a whole bunch of people to a vaccine or placebo and then see how many people get COVID. And so what we've got so far, roughly speaking, and all we've been given are the number of cases. We don't know exactly how many people have been enrolled in the trial, so we're ballparking these numbers. And I'll post the numbers that I'm using on our website at the end of this. So let's go through the Pfizer vaccine. What we've seen so far is 162 cases of COVID in the placebo group and 8 cases in the vaccine group. If you cut the number of people in half, instead of 44,000, and assume that half of them are getting placebo and half of them are getting a vaccine, you have a denominator of 22,000. When you do that, that now tells us that in the placebo group, about 0.7% of people ended up getting COVID, or about 1 in 142 people. So that's where we are right now with the placebo group. In the vaccine group, about 8 cases occurred in about 22,000 people. Again, that's a rate of about 0.04%, or about 1 in 2,500. If you do the math on that, and I'm not going to do it right, I'm not going to do it in any way other than tell you, that is a relative difference of about 95%. So 1 in 142 versus 1 in 2500 converts to about a 95% benefit. And if you really, if you know, for those you follow the podcast, we always like to talk about absolute benefits. And I think there's a legitimate reason to do that just for completeness sake. But it, there's so many nuances around this. But I'll give you the numbers anyway. So it's pretty simple. 0.7% versus 0.04%. So that's about a 0.66% benefit. So we could do numbers needed to vaccinate and all that sort of stuff. But roughly, we're talking about just, you know, between a half and a 1% absolute benefit, if you would.
In an environment where people are not always, but for the most part, trying to reduce the risk of contracting this.
Yeah, no, exactly. And in fact, you know, the baseline rate of 1 in 142 is actually relatively high. You know,
you think that's high? It's interesting.
No, I do. I think it's high in regards, and it depends on how we define that. Because if you, I don't think in BC we have 1 in 142 people getting it. Now, these people are all being tested, so it's all kind of tricky that way to put it into that sort of context. So,
yeah, see, it's interesting because I look at this number and you're right as far as some areas. Like if you took the East Coast of Canada, 0.7% would be quite high.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
But if you imagine a world where people are interacting without reservation or being careful and precautious,
yeah, that's true.
That number would, I suspect, be quite a bit higher. Yeah. Certainly, that was the case in outbreaks where it was unexpected.
Yeah.
And so the 0.7, I think you're right, James, it's our nature to give the absolute benefit. And I think that's important, but in this case where it will be so driven by baseline risk, mm-hmm. It is important to recognize that the relative benefit, it's an important number as well, or perhaps even more important.
Yeah.
Because if the time frame is a year and we look at it over a year and risk goes up to something like 5 to 10%,
yeah.
That 95% reduction makes, that's where it really makes a huge difference.
And I think the way to think about the 95% is to go, of the people who are going to get COVID, it prevents 95% of those people from getting it.
Yeah.
That's probably the best way to think about it. And these, the studies are being done, they're not only being done in, you know, the highest risk people, but they're definitely not enrolling people who would by definition be at really low risk, because it makes it much more difficult to show whether or not there's an effect. So I think this is not an unreasonable population, and I think these populations, at least with the Pfizer vaccine, there are many different countries that are involved in enrolling people in this. So those are the results of the number of people who got COVID. One of the concerns when the very first initial results of Pfizer, of the results came out, there was no mention of what about the serious cases. So we've got 1 in 142 versus 1 in 2500, and 162 cases versus 8 cases. Now, they've defined this as serious cases. I couldn't find anywhere how they defined that because it's not being published. But they said there were 10 serious cases in the placebo group and 1 in the vaccine. So that's encouraging in that it is also appears to be having an impact on serious cases, which I think really, Mike, is really the whole reason why we need a vaccine.
Right. It's no one wants to feel sick, not even from a common cold. But we want to keep people out of hospital. We want to allow them to continue working and all of that stuff, even if it's working from home, et cetera. And so, and taking care of their kids and all that stuff.
Exactly.
So, we want to avoid serious infections. And you know, it made me think as we were going along and we were talking about it as a nightmare. And we have to remember it was an absolute nightmare for many people because they either died or lost loved ones.
Absolutely.
To this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, for sure. So that was what we found out on November 18th from the Pfizer vaccine. It was the second report of that Pfizer vaccine, by the way. And then we have the Moderna vaccine, which is the results are really quite similar. About 30,000 people. Mm-hmm. And in this case, again, 90 cases in the placebo group, 5 cases in the vaccine group. If you do the math, it's now 0.6% or 1 in 167. And then in the vaccine group, 5 cases out of 15,000 people is a rate of about 0.03% or 1 in 3,000. And again, if you do the math on that, it's about a 95% benefit. And the absolute benefit is about 0.6%, very similar to what we saw with the Pfizer vaccine. And when you look at serious cases, it was 11 in the placebo and none in the vaccine. And I haven't seen statistics on it, but those serious cases that I just reported to you for both of these studies in a population of 44,000, those numbers will be statistically significantly different.
Almost. I don't even know if I need them to be to believe that something positive is happening here.
Exactly.
Now, And we've talked a lot about what statistical significance is and its limits because of the cut points that are arbitrary, et cetera.
Yeah.
The key thing here is this vaccine, we don't know how long it works. There's lots of limits.
Oh, yeah. We're going to get to all of this. Yeah.
Adverse events and all of that. But it does look very promising by the numbers. It's unfortunate that all we have is press releases, but those press releases were surprisingly detailed.
Oh yeah.
For what you normally get from them. You usually just get it had a 30% relative reduction as far as the drug.
Exactly.
And it's not even says relative, it just says reduction. And then you have to spend time to figure it out. This one actually gave case numbers.
Yeah, which is crucial.
Which is and unique.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I would say. So kudos to them. I understand why they wanted to do it. I think most of it was because they want you to buy their vaccine and use their vaccine. But I also think some of it is they recognize that people need hope right now.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And I think we're going to talk about, buying and not buying, because most of these vaccines, to my understanding, have already been bought. And that's
it's been paid for.
Yeah. So that, it's another. And I thought one more nuance just to put it into context. I couldn't find the population who was studied in the Pfizer vaccine, but there is for the Moderna one. It's good. A quarter of the participants are 65 years or older. And this is again from this, white people make up 63% of the volunteers, 20% are Hispanic, 10% are Black, and 4% are Asian Americans. So
actually a good mix compared to what we normally see in clinical trials, where predominantly Caucasians makes you kind of scratch your head about how applicable it is externally. So
I couldn't find a breakdown of gender or anything like that, but I would imagine it would be really close to 50-50 if I had to bet. I don't think there's any doubt. So this is where we are right now. That's the information that we have. And I thought what would be useful is to sort of talk about some of the issues around this. Because, we hear so much. I know you're not on Twitter, Mike. But, and it makes you more of a sane person if you're not. But, there's a lot of news reporting and talking about this and all of the issues. And there's people who are very much against vaccines or people who are pro vaccines and all that sort of stuff. And I think one of the biggest concerns that people might have is around the concept of industry bias. And I think, Mike, you and I we've done podcasts in the past about this whole issue. There is no doubt there is an industry bias.
I think you should, James, you're being reserved there. They are outright evil.
Is that what you've said in the past?
That's supposed to take.
Oh, Michael, it's such a chore dealing with you on a podcast by podcast basis. But there are numerous studies showing that there is an industry bias in a variety of different ways, and we should expect that to be the case because it's. They are industry. If you owned a business, you would be somewhat biased in how you present it.
If I was selling ice cream and there was another ice cream shop down the way, I would be telling what's better about my ice cream than the ice cream down the way. And we have to expect that. It's actually, I've argued before that most of the weight is on us as clinicians to kind of be skeptical and reserved, not skeptical enough to. Like I mean, I was joking, as you know, but there are people out there who, is the study funded by industry? Well, then nothing can be believed.
Yeah, which is ridiculous.
Yeah, that's obviously way too far. And as you've pointed out, some of the hallmarks of quality in clinical trials are actually frequently done better by industry. Yeah. And that's why is that? It's not that the industry is a lot smarter than people who are using public funding. It's that they have more money
to do it properly, to
tick all the boxes and hire the right people, and particularly follow up. They have money to chase people publicly funded studies don't have.
Yeah. And I think there is some, you know, is there an industry bias in this? Well, probably somewhat, but I think this is we're in a unique time. And I think the unique thing is that, and Mike, I'm going to ask you, it's a rhetorical question, so I don't really need an answer, but I'm sure you will. This is unique. This is the first thing that pretty much everybody in the people who are in the industry who are studying it, they will be taking it. Even the executives. So, you know, I see that there is much less risk of sort of a bias towards a positive outcome because of that. Does that mean it's eliminates it? Absolutely not. But this is a very unique situation. Pretty much everybody who is studying it, everybody who is funding it, and everybody who is involved in any to do with the studies will likely end up taking it.
And get their kids to take it and get their family to take it.
Exactly.
And yeah, like this is one of those things. You're right. It's not very often that something gets produced by any company and all those involved will be interested in taking it.
Yeah.
That's pretty rare.
Yeah. And basically, like, the world is watching this. I mean, everybody is having oversight on this. I mean, the oversight is going to be phenomenal on this. Mm-hmm. And there are, and you know, certainly everything I've heard is that this is a joint, everybody's working together on this. And I think, but everyone has an agenda. Everyone has, you know, government has an agenda. Industry have an agenda. We as a public have an agenda. So I am quite confident in that what we're seeing is likely very close to what is going on. But is there money in it? There's a phenomenal amount of money in it. But we're all going to end up taking it. But, you know, as we've been going forward in this, being a, I think a couple circumstances, at least one that I can remember, where the trials were stopped because of adverse effects. Mm-hmm. You know, or at least halted is a better way of thinking about it.
Transverse myelitis, I think, was one of them, which can occur, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
It can occur, and it's one of these rare Guillain-Barré type.
Yeah.
Like, it can occur. I've seen it in practice.
Yeah. And it can happen without taking a vaccine.
Yeah, the person that I had didn't have a vaccine.
Yeah, exactly.
Whatever they had that triggered it.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's terrifying when you see it happen, myelitis. So, I understand why they wanted to give pause and open the data to make sure they weren't missing something. But that's the problem with all clinical trials, right? And we've talked about this a lot. So I'm in a clinical trial and what we want to do in clinical trials is make sure that when something happens to someone, we don't jump to the conclusion that it was not caused by the product.
Yeah.
And so I get my first dose of, let's say, vitamin water. Mm-hmm. And I get in my car and I'm driving home and I get in a car crash. That is due, in that clinical trial, that car crash is due to the vitamin water and, you know, really until verified otherwise.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And so we have to assume that every adverse event is caused by the product. And that's why adverse events, if you look at the cannabis clinical trials, even in the placebo arm, the adverse events are 60% or something
there. So
it's common. And the whole idea of counting total adverse events to the end in long trials, everyone's going to have had the sniffles. They're going to have had a stubbed toe.
Yeah. Trying to find out, is there a difference?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So obviously, we definitely need the publications for the full oversight and review. But if anyone is hanging their hat on peer review as preventing or making sure publications are perfect, you're crazy.
Yeah, well, that's because they haven't had a peer-reviewed article come back.
Yeah, yeah.
Before. Like once you've been on the receiving end of peer review, some of it is brilliant.
It can be great.
Some of it is like you're blown away by how high quality is. And these are going to be in big journals, and they're going to be reviewed by high quality people or high quality reviewers. But the reality is, even that can't catch everything.
No, exactly. Yeah.
And
then, you know, people worry, well, what, you know, why are they giving out sort of interim analyses? Well, interim analyses are done all the time in all of research.
It's actually
unethical not to.
Yeah. I'd hope that you would want that. Now, if you look at statistics and you're using the interim analysis to decide whether to end trial early, et cetera, for benefit, then you're supposed to modify your statistical testing to account for multiple testing. That is what you're supposed to do. Yeah. Many people don't, and they just try and limit the amount of interim analysis to kind of one or two. But if you think about it, what if something like this was working like Dynamite, and you had originally slated it to go 2 years? And after 6 months, you could figure out that it would be help to people. It might be wrong to keep it going. As well, it might be wrong if it was hurting people.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. What if more people in the placebo arm were living longer?
Yeah, exactly.
It wouldn't be a good idea to keep a trial going. Yeah. So, interim analysis have a place, and I think they're quite reasonable. It's to prevent harms from occurring.
Yeah, really. And again, it's unique in this case in that the world is hoping that this is going to work. So I think it's a legitimate thing to put it into the public as well. I really do.
Because they want to consume that information.
Yeah, no, exactly. And then there's also, you know, there's an approval process for getting a medication to the market. And, you know, this is going to be very rapidly approved. But it's supposed to be. That's the whole process. But I don't think anyone is making it so that they're, you know, there's not going to be loose ends. Because if I think about it, and I was trying to think about this, almost no medications are being given to 30,000 people before they are approved. In fact, I cannot think of one.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when you see a new, you know, when ranitidine was brought onto the market,
I don't think you're going down with this.
No, but it doesn't matter. Whatever medication, when a medication is being approved and marketed, it is not uncommon that it's only being given to maybe a few thousand people.
Or less.
Oh, yeah, it could be definitely less. Yeah, but I'm saying even...
I was with CDAC, and there are certain drugs that were less than 100.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, exactly. And so this is 30,000 people. I mean, obviously split it in two because only half of them get it. But this is 30,000 people are going to be exposed to this before it's going to be approved. So again, this is almost unheard of as far as having information and knowing about it. Now, the key aspect of it is that... obviously, the follow-up so far is only 3 to 4 months. So, but even that is relatively long, because I can tell you right now, when, you know, ranitidine or whatever medication is, they didn't follow people 3 to 4 months after they took that medication.
Well, in fact, and James, you and I just spent yesterday doing a grade meeting with the rest of Peer, mm-hmm. and the number of clinical trials for chronic illness, that in this case chronic pain, that went beyond 12 weeks was, I think, a tiny handful.
Yeah, exactly. So,
so it's not, and that's 3 months. So it's, again, is it perfect? You and I would, in a perfect world, I'd love this to go longer. But in that same perfect world, we wouldn't have COVID.
Yeah, no, exactly. And there will be longer follow up. I will bet that there is a process. I don't know, but I would imagine they're going to be followed up longer than that. Will they be followed up as microscopically as they were in a study? Probably not. But there will be following up. And when we come to approval, and not so much approval, there is always an independent data safety monitoring board that is looking at these things for interim analyses. And that's the whole reason that we do this. And so, you know, I think it's, I think from an approval perspective, people go, it's being approved so quickly and blah, blah, blah. Well, yes. And there's a reason for that, but look what we're actually doing to get it approved. So,
there's also, you need to recognize, like, cause you've been on patented medicine prices review board. I've been on the Canadian Expert Drug Advisory Committee. Yeah. And when they come, you know, you fit it into your you know when the meeting's coming and you're fitting it in and all of that stuff. When something like this comes across your desk and you're with, let's say, the FDA or the Therapeutics Product Directorate in Canada, you know, you're not really spending a lot of time scheduling it in. You're dropping everything to go through this that day. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? When it arrives, people are going to be, if you're in this position where you have to review this, you're going to be waiting for this to arrive. Yeah. And there would be virtually nothing that would stop you from putting it number one priority first thing.
And again, for all the same reasons why, because the people who are on those boards will be taking the vaccine in theory.
Yeah, they want it for themselves, their kids.
And their family,
also want to go back to going to the movies and not having to wear masks in the future, not being able to see their family whenever they like. Like, it's only natural that they all want to expedite this.
Yeah, yeah.
Only naysayers, and there will always
be
naysayers
.
Who... I'm not a big fan of looking for science to solve large problems in society, but this is one that actually can be solved and looks like we're on the right path.
Yeah, yeah, no, for sure. And then, so those are sort of some of the things to think about. And I think there's some general comments that we can make. I mean, the unique thing about vaccines is, in contrast to almost any other medication, like, no one takes a statin to reduce the risk of a heart attack in someone else. I mean, that just doesn't happen. But, you know, vaccines are somewhat a unique beast in that the treatment has the potential to benefit others. Mm-hmm. And I think so that's another, not a threshold, but it's another caveat that you need to think about. And then people are going to be worried, well, what about a rare adverse, or a rare serious reaction or a severe reaction? Is that possible? Absolutely. And will a 1 in 20 to 40,000 risk be picked up in any of these studies? No. I mean, you might see one case, but you won't be to know if it was that. You will pick up if, and I believe they're being monitored closely enough, you will pick up if it's one in a few hundred, in 1 in 1,000, probably you could pick that up. We're picking up, and the reason you can be comfortable with that is we're picking up the number of people who are getting COVID is in the vaccine group is over 1 in 1,000. Mm-hmm. So I think you can do that. And in case anyone didn't realize that, pretty much any medication, or pretty much not any medication, every medication has about a 1 in 20,000 to 40,000 risk of a severe reaction.
Yeah. So, and actually, I would go as far as to say life. Right? There's a crossing the street, you can trip over bang your head. You can get hit by a car. You can get a bee sting that you find out that you're actually now anaphylactic to. Like, there's it is. So I know what you're saying. It's drugs, but risk is out there.
Yeah.
And so we're always balancing risk.
Yeah.
In our lives, every time we cross the street, all of these things, every time we get in our car, we want to go see our friends. We need to pick up some groceries. Yeah. There is a risk there. And actually sometimes when we calculate costs in medicine, one of the things that is accounted for is the risk of a motor vehicle crash for going for medical tests and those kind of things. So risks are there and we account for them all the time. And is the chance of avoiding COVID and passing it on to others worth a 1 in 20,000, 1 in 40,000 severe reaction?
Yeah. But the point that I was sort of suggesting is if you take any medication ever, you have put yourself at a 1 in 20 to 40,000 risk of a severe reaction. You know what I mean? So if you're against the vaccine because of the potential of that severe risk, it makes no sense because we will always have that and we may never be able to pick it up or pick it out. Anyway, it's tricky. But the neat thing, the nice thing about it, although, with a vaccine, you don't take it every day. And we don't actually know how often you have to take it. I think these are they're repeated 3-4 weeks. I think
I think they're 4 weeks apart, two shots, four weeks apart.
Exactly. But some of the things, here's what we don't know. And we will know this at some point. We certainly don't know it now.
How long does our resistance last? Our immunity last?
Yeah. But there's a variety of other benefits is that in this case, with vaccines, you get a peace of mind. Now, you get a peace of mind because we've created such a horrible, not, we didn't create the COVID, obviously, but well, some people say we did, but that's a whole other story. But you also get, you get peace of mind if you've taken the vaccine, which you typically don't get from other treatments. I guess you can a little bit, you know, if you take a drug for your blood pressure, you get a peace of mind or whatever. But it's, you know, you're going to get, even if it's such a very small absolute benefit, you get the peace of mind of that you, if you were going to get infected, you would probably be, your risk would be 95% less.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. If you come in contact with the infection, exactly. You've reduced.
And then
you're not giving it to others too, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And as you pointed out, we're all being harmed by COVID. There is mm-hmm. literally not a person on the face of the planet who's not being harmed by it, not by necessarily getting it, but the implications of it.
Yeah.
And you know, as well as I do, we're exposed to live things and live viruses all the time. And your body makes an immune response. That's just kind of the way it works.
Yeah.
And then the only other thing I thought about is that people are concerned that this is a sort of a new way of making a vaccine, which is true. That they're called messenger RNA vaccines in comparison to mm-hmm. sort of the DNA ones. And to my understanding, if it gets approved, this will be the very first mRNA type of vaccine being approved. And so people are a bit nervous about that. But you know, these types of vaccines are being studied for years, or being the process has been in place for a number of years. This is not something that just we all of a sudden developed a week after the COVID started. But they're somewhat subtly unique in their. Here's the best of my understanding of how they work: that these sort of gene-based vaccines carry sort of genetic instructions for the host cells to make the antigen. That's kind of what they're doing. And so you're actually not sort of giving them a protein or a dead virus. You're actually giving the genetic material that makes the person create an antibody response. And so it's a unique way of doing it. And there's a whole bunch of actual advantages to it. Because, in fact, it should be a more specific response. And you can actually, your body, if you just inject a dead virus or something, your body can just quickly chew it up and not create much of a response. So there's some potential advantages. The reason, to my understanding, is that why we haven't seen any mRNA ones is, as you probably heard about, the Pfizer one has to be, I think it has to be kept at 0 degrees Kelvin.
Yeah. It's not quite that low. I'm just saying, yeah, that you need special freezing units, and then when you just move it to the fridge and room temperature, you've got a much more limited time frame in which to use it than a normal vaccine.
Yeah, so that needs to be, but that's one of the main reasons why there are not being other mRNA vaccines, and so I'm sure there's a process that we're working on trying to figure out how you can deal with the instability of it and deliver it in a way that's appropriate.
But that's why it's such a great vaccine for Canada, because you can just carry it around outside during winter and it's
fine. Absolutely. And you know, if you're feeling a little bit tickled in your cough, take a shot. It's a beautiful thing. And then of course there is a few unknowns, even where we are right now. We've already talked a little bit about it. We don't know the duration. Right, we don't know how long the immune response is going to last. There are studies that are being started in children, but none of these enrolled children. So we don't know about that. And, you know, Mike, we talked a little bit about this earlier. These studies don't look at spread. There is no, they're not designed to look at that. They're looking about whether an individual gets it. We don't know whether or not it reduces spread. In theory, it should, because less people are getting it, but we don't know. And these studies will not tell us that.
Yeah, no, they won't. But it's an incredibly hard design. You and I chatted about this before the podcast started. And
yeah.
I think what they've done here is pretty impressive. And I'm not patting industry too hard on the back here, because there's a lot of other people involved, including you as a taxpayer, you were involved directly or indirectly by paying your taxes, and that money ended up supporting a lot of this. And that's why James was saying earlier on that we've kind of already paid for these vaccines.
Yeah.
the governments all over the world invested in this research.
Yeah, and more so with some than others. It's not.
Yes.
You know, it is a. If you try and sort of figure out who paid for all these things, it varies. You know, between the one company had more sort of private partner, private public partners, and others didn't. And so it's tricky to know. But you know, I am exceedingly impressed with this, and certainly, you know, if I can't really come up with a good reason. We've talked about the potential limitations, but I can't come up with a good reason to not to not take it. Once we get to that point. Now, I would not have wanted to be the very first person to have this injected into me. Why? I don't know. Just didn't feel right. But now that I know, that you know, we're gonna have what probably you know get, when we get the end of it, you know, upwards of 70,000 or 80,000 people. Because the big concern I've always worried about, you know, especially when you give a drug to the first person ever, you always worry about, you know, of some severe allergic reaction that kills them within about a minute. But maybe I've just seen that in movies. But no, this vaccine has incredible oversight. As we've talked about, the world is looking at this, and there will be lots and lots and lots of people looking at this. And so what we've tried to do is give you the numbers, give you what you know so far, and then some of the issues that we need to need to think about, the industry bias, how we approve these things, and just some general ways of thinking about it. And is there anything else you want to add, Mike? I think we've done a decent
job. No, that's good,
job,
James. I think we've covered it as much as we can from a press release without any harms data. We've looked at harms data for other vaccines. If it's similar, then it's going to be site reactions mostly.
Yeah, and some people. Now, here's what's interesting. You're right. There's no safety data. But what I can tell you, if there was a with all these interim analyses on in it, if there was anything suggestive of a serious problem, that would have been addressed. Well, and how do we know that? Because remember, we've seen some of these trials halted.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the whole point of there is an independent group that looks at this stuff that is not they're independent. That is called an independent data safety monitoring board. And most research has these in place, and they're done to as much as possible remove the problem of bias.
Yeah.
One thing I thought was interesting, it's going to be interesting if at some point they will let the people who are enrolled in these studies know whether or not they got placebo. Here's an interesting thing. Most clinical trials never tell you.
Yeah, this is different. I think you're going to have to tell them, and you're going to have to give them the option. Usually there's an escape clause in many trials, right? So if it's something like this where you at the end of it, you can get it. Or like, for example, the recent one we talked about, was the stockings for recurrent cellulitis and swollen legs. If you got a bout of cellulitis, you hit the escape clause and you got to go and get stockings.
Oh, yeah.
If you were stockings armed. And so there's
but I'm pretty sure people would know whether they were putting them on. I mean,
other ones too that are drug trials that you know, if you get an event that's the event being measured, once you get it, you're allowed to. And if it's something going to be recurrent, you can then get the intervention as well. So there is
if you get a bad reaction, you will unblind it for that individual. But I bet people didn't know this. It's actually quite unusual at the end of a study. For the people who went through the study, not the people who got hurt, you know, or had it and had, they are not told very often.
But there is trials where at the end they give them, I can't remember them off the top of my head, but there are lots of clinical trials where, especially expensive products for, I remember for some of the conditions like
rheumatoid arthritis,
kind of stuff, where at the end of it, you get to get
get it, but you still don't find out whether you got it.
Yeah.
That which is really an interesting process, because I've always argued that if you enroll a person into a study, you should, they're doing work for you. they, you know, you really should tell them. But anyway, that's a whole other ethical dilemma that we ran into when I was part of a clinical research ethics board and stuff. So, but it's really interesting. Anyway, hopefully this has been useful. You now know the numbers. And anything else you want to talk about, Mike, or should we just leave it at that?
No, that's all good, I think.
Yeah. Okay, excellent. So just leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.